The Chaldean mysteries can be traced up to the days of Semiramis. Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. The Chaldean mysteries can be traced up to the days of Semiramis, who lived only a few centuries after the flood, and who is known to have impressed upon them, that is the Chaldean mysteries, the image of her own depraved and polluted mind. Now, for the age of Shem, the son of Noah, you can calculate it from Genesis 11. Shem lived 502 years after the flood, which, according to the Hebrew chronology, means he lived till B.C. 1846, is what Hislop says. The age of Ninus, the husband of Semiramis, or Nimrod, according to Eusebius, synchronized with that of Abraham, who was born B.C. 1996. It was only about 9 years, however, before the end of the reign of Ninus that the birth of Abraham is said to have taken place. Consequently, on this view, the reign of Ninus must have terminated about B.C. 1987. Clinton, who is of high authority, Hislop goes on to say, in chronology, places the reign of Ninus somewhat earlier. He makes his age to have been B.C. 2182. Lollard, the famous archaeologist in his Nineveh and its Remains, adopts Clinton's opinion. Semiramis is said to have survived her husband 42 years. Whatever view, therefore, be adopted in regard to the age of Ninus, whether that of Eusebius or that at which Clinton and Layard arrived, debates being obvious, it is evident that Shem long survived both Ninus and his wife. A lot of people wonder why so little is said in the Bible about Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth after the chronologies and after the flood. The reason is God raised up Abraham to start a new elect people. You will be able to find out tracings of the sons of Noah in other sources. But because they aren't mentioned much in the Bible, it's forgotten that they lived for several generations after the flood. Semiramis, wife of Nimrod, became the instrument of Satan to establish the Babylonian mysteries, which, grafted onto the medieval church, produced so many of our so-called Christian traditions, including Christmas. And that's the subject matter for this marvelous Christmas season. Started by an old whore. Now we're off and running tonight, aren't we? That beautiful but abandoned queen of Babylon was not only herself a paragon of unbridled lust and licentiousness, but in the mysteries which she had a chief hand in forming, she was worshipped as Rhea, the great mother of the gods, with such atrocious rites as identified her with Venus, the mother of all impurity, and raised the very city where she had reigned to a bad eminence among the nations as the grand seat at once of idolatry and consecrated prostitution. Herodotus pointed this out, the so-called father of history, the classic Greek historian. Thus was the Chaldean queen a fit and remarkable prototype of the woman in the apocalypse, with a golden cup in her hand and the name in her forehead Mystery, Babylon the Great, The Mother of Harlots, and Abominations of the Earth. The apocalyptic emblem of the harlot woman with the cup in her hand was even embodied in the symbols of idolatry derived from ancient Babylon as they were exhibited in Greece. For thus was the Greek Venus originally represented. And it is singular that in our own day, and so far as appears for the first time, the Roman Church has actually taken this very symbol as her own chosen emblem. In 1825, on the occasion of the Jubilee, Pope Leo XII struck a medal bearing on the one side his own image. There's a picture of it over here. Bearing on the one side his own image, and on the other, that of the Church of Rome, symbolized as a woman holding in her left hand a cross, and in her right hand a cup, with the legend around her, Sedet Super Universum, the whole world is her seat. Now, the period when Semiramis lived, a period when the patriarchal faith was still fresh in the minds of men, when Shem was still alive to rouse the minds of the faithful to rally around the banner for the truth and cause of God, made it hazardous all at once and publicly to set up such a system as was inaugurated with a Babylonian queen. But she did it. And she did it effectively. I want to skip along. So the original of that mother, so widely worshipped and identified with the medieval church, was Semiramis, worshipped by the Babylonians and other Eastern nations, winning, except for the area around Jerusalem, over Shem. And she was worshipped under the name of Rhea, which Semiramis had adopted as her own, the great goddess mother. But, and I'm ad-libbing things in between here, to carry out Satan's purpose of the substitute or counterfeit to God's plan of salvation. It was from the Son, however, that she derived all her glory and her claims to deification. That Son, though represented as a child in his mother's arms, was a person of great stature and immense bodily powers, as well as most fascinating manners. In Scripture, he is referred to, in Ezekiel 8, under the name of Tammuz, but he is commonly known among classical writers under the name of Bacchus, that is, the Lamented One. To the ordinary reader, the name of Bacchus suggests nothing more than revelry and drunkenness, but it is now well known that amid all the abominations that attended his orgies, their grand design was professedly the purification of souls, and that from the guilt and defilement of sin. This Lamented One, exhibited and adored as a little child in his mother's arms, seems in point of fact to have been the husband of Semiramis, whose name Ninus, by which he is commonly known in classical history, biblical history, as Nimrod, literally signified the sun, S-O-N, not S-U-N. As Semiramis, the wife was worshipped as Rhea, whose grand distinguishing character was that of the great goddess mother, the conjunction with her of her husband under the name of Ninus, or the Son, was sufficient to originate the peculiar worship of the mother and son. So extensively diffused among the nations of antiquity. And this, no doubt, is the explanation of the fact, which has so much puzzled the inquirers into ancient history, that Ninus is sometimes called the husband and sometimes the son of Semiramis. Am I boring you? You notice the whole world gets real religious twice a year. The mother and son time at Christmas and Easter. A cognate of the word or name Ishtar, which is but another name for Semiramis. I'd say Satan's got his stamp on things. I wouldn't care if these heathen days were used to teach Christianity. If we'd, you know, stand on a soapbox and say, we've taken their very days and used them as an opportunity to teach Christ. That isn't what happens. We teach a Christ shaped like the heathen myth. I think where I differ from Hislop and others is I'm not afraid of borrowing the heathen days and standing on a soapbox and using them to proclaim the truth of God by contrast. It's that the world has bought the bill of goods and actually thinks this ingraftation is history about Christ. I mean, Hislop's attitude is we ought to shun any heralding of these dates at all. I'd just soon herald them, point out their foolishness, the shortcomings of the substitute, and use Christmas as a time to talk about the Christ that was born in September. This that I've just read also accounts for the origin of the very same confusion of relationship between Isis and Osiris, the mother and child of the Egyptians. Sem, you know, in Egyptian, quote, mythology, as we were mentioning the other night, kills Osiris and inspires the vengeance of Isis. Now you'll find Isis on the little holy cakes used in the more ritual communion services. Yet most people who do it don't know what the eye is for. And though Jesus used bread that he broke, using as his starting point the tradition of the Passover, ever since medieval days, churches who want to be liturgical use little round wafers shaped for the sun. Instead of breaking the bread. Osiris was represented in Egypt as at once the son and husband of his mother, and actually bore as one of his titles of dignity and honor the name husband of the mother. This still further casts light on the fact that the Indian god Iswara is represented as a babe on the breast of his own wife, Isi, or Parvati. Now this Ninus, or son, born in the arms of the Babylonian Madonna, is so described as very clearly to identify him with Nimrod. Ninus, king of the Assyrians, and that name had wide latitude among classic authors, taking in the Babylonians as well as the Assyrians proper, because they all came to attack the Palestinian area through the same route. Ninus, king of the Syrians, which could just as easily be Babylonians in classic writers, says Trogus Pompeius, epitomized by Justin, first of all changed the contented moderation of the ancient manners, incited by a new passion, the desire of conquest. He was the first who carried on war against his neighbors, as they were yet unacquainted with the arts of war. The account of Diodorus Siculus entirely agrees with this and adds another trait that goes still further to determine the identity. That account is as follows. Ninus, the most ancient of the Assyrian kings mentioned in history, performed great actions. Being naturally of a warlike disposition, see, Assyria was just north of Babylon, and Babylon began to be viewed as separate from Assyria after the Medes conquered the Assyrians and Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon rose up in strength with his capital at Babylon instead of Nineveh. But the most ancient kingdom formed there in the Fertile Crescent was Nimrod's kingdom, and classic authors tended to refer to that earlier kingdom as Assyrians, though later on another Assyrian kingdom with its capital at Nineveh would more restrict the territory. Ninus, the most ancient, to continue Diodorus, of the Assyrian kings mentioned in history, performed great actions. Being naturally of a warlike disposition and ambitious of glory that results from valor, he armed a considerable number of young men that were brave and vigorous like himself, trained them up a long time in laborious exercises and hardships, and by that means accustomed them to bear the fatigues of war and to face, to bear the fatigues of war and to face dangers with intrepidity. Diodorus thus makes Ninus the most ancient of Assyrian kings and represents him as beginning those wars which raised his power to an extraordinary height. Hello, Los Angeles, where in the hell you been? Where are these people that join us in the middle of the day? And Nick, you want to fix my clock till it's somewhere near what time is supposed to be? We're reading from The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. Diodorus, we're linking Ninus and ancient classical writers to Nimrod. Ninus being the name given to the husband of Semiramis, that evil woman who outlived her husband, wife of Nimrod, who brought into being the mystery religions of Babylon, making herself Rhea, the mother to be worshipped, and her son identified as both her husband and son, because she would contend, though not said yet in this book, if it's said at all, I don't know, that her husband, when he died, was God, who returned to his position, stellar position, as the sun, and the sunbeam caused the conception and reincarnation of Nimrod, called Tammuz or Bacchus or a multitude of names. Diodorus of Sicily, Diodorus Siculus, is the one that we're quoting now. He makes Ninus the most ancient of Assyrian kings, represents him as beginning those wars which raised his power to an extraordinary height by bringing the people of Babylonia under subjection to him, while as yet the city of Babylon was not in existence. This shows that he occupied the very position of Nimrod, of whom the scriptural account is that he first began to be mighty on the earth, and that the beginning of his kingdom was Babylon. As the Babel builders, when their speech was confounded, were scattered abroad on the face of the earth, and therefore deserted both the city and the tower which they had commenced to build. Babylon as a city could not properly be said to exist till Nimrod, by establishing his power there, made it the foundation and starting point of his greatness. In this respect, then, the story of Ninus and of Nimrod exactly harmonize. The way, too, in which Ninus gained his power is the very way in which Nimrod erected his. There can be no doubt that it was by inuring his followers to the toils and dangers of the chase that he gradually formed them to the use of arms and so prepared them for aiding him in establishing his dominions, just as Ninus, by training his companions for a long time in laborious exercises and hardships, qualified them for making him the first of the Assyrian kings. Now, the importance of this is that you can learn a lot about Nimrod, who's briefly referred to in Scripture as the first rebel, which his name means, by recognizing that the other classic sources about Ninus, the husband of Semiramis, speaks of none other than Nimrod. In Genesis 10:11, we find a passage which, when its meaning is properly understood, casts a very steady light on the subject. That passage, as given in the Authorized Version, runs this way. Quote, "Out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh," end quote. This speaks of it as something remarkable, that Asher went forth or went out of the land of Shinar, while yet the human race in general went forth from the same land. It goes upon the supposition that Asher had some sort of divine right to that land, and that he had been, in a manner, expelled from it by Nimrod. While no divine right is elsewhere hinted at in the context or seems capable of proof. Moreover, it represents Asher as setting up in the immediate neighborhood of Nimrod as mighty a kingdom as Nimrod himself. Asher building four cities, one of which is emphatically said to have been great. While Nimrod, on this interpretation, built just the same number of cities, of which none is specially characterized as great. Now, it is in the last degree improbable that Nimrod would have quietly borne so mighty a rival so near him. To obviate such difficulties as these, you want me to do that now?
Yes, sir.
Why? Yeah, I want to know. I want to know. That's what I need. I need a want to know. I want to know. I want to know why you folks in Los Angeles are joining us in the middle of the day late. We've been here for a long time. Oh, don't play it yet. Now, I could continue this. In fact, I'd like to. I find it fascinating, too. The interconnections that, when tied together, show the battle of the ages. Satan attempting to frustrate and defeat the plan of God and the faithfulness of God in its demonstration, and God's continuous searching for those that would be faithful to his word. God will win the ultimate outcome. I think we're part of that winning. And to see the battle in broad gestalt is to put some importance beyond the normal in the task that God calls us to. For years, people could not identify the lost tribes because it was the purpose of God that they be hidden. For a minimum number of years, until a punishment period prophesied in Leviticus would run. Beginning in the last decade, of the 1700s and into the 1800s, as the time spans begin to run, then archaeology, in God's set times, I believe, uncovered the clues that would enable us in these last days to identify the lost tribes. Because Ezekiel 37, the chapter preceding the so-called Russian chapters of Ezekiel, which are last day events, in the action by Ezekiel to take the two sticks and put the name Joseph and the name Judah on them and bring them together, require the emergence in realization of who the house of Israel is, the lost, so-called lost tribes, that they might be joined with Judah. Archaeology gave the keys by letting us know that they had names different in their bondage territories, the place of imprisonment, than they were known in the Bible. When we begin to recognize the Persians called them Saki or Sakasuni, and that the Assyrians called them Vit Kumri or Umri or Humri, we were then able, through archaeology and ancient classical historians, to begin to trace their wanderings. Likewise, the discovery that classical historians refer to the wife of Semiramis as Ninus, or Ninus, we are then able to see that Nimrod and his activities can be traced through this name that classical historians put on him. We're able to fill in supplemental details and relate it to Scripture, and furthermore, prove Scripture in its accuracy. Nimrod and Ninus are one and the same. Nimrod's the name we encounter in Scripture. Ninus, or Ninus, the name we encounter in classical history. Now to Genesis 10:11. It reads, let's start with the 8th verse. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. 9th verse, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, whose name means rebel, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calna in the land of Shinar. Well, a beginning presupposes the following. Out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah, and reason between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city, in Mizraim. We'll come back to him later. The point that Hyslop is making, and very valid, is if Nimrod was so great, none of the cities he built, Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna in the land of Shinar, get the eulogy of Calah being a great city. Nineveh being built by Asher is the implication in the 11th verse. Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna built by Nimrod. The impression being there were two city builders, Nimrod and Asher. And Asher must have been better at it than Nimrod, because he built a city that was a great city, where Nimrod built four, but none of them are called great. That's the impression. And some biblical interpreters say Asher must have been a big shot in Shinar, and Nimrod drove him out. Nimrod stayed in Shinar, built Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna. Asher went and built Nineveh and Rehoboth and Calah, And the one that Asher built was a great city. Hislop's quite right. He's saying if Nineveh was so great, how could he put up with a more powerful neighbor called Asher to the north? Got it? How do we obviate the difficulty? Oh, you don't care. Mike's over there dancing up and down on his toes. He's eager. You don't care?
Yes, sir.
You're not interested in Genesis?
Yes, sir.
I don't want any applause. Oh, you can't get to me like that. You know how you get to me? The phones haven't jammed yet. I came early. I want to be pampered. In the book of Genesis, don't take any more calls. Chapters 10 and 11 are among the most interesting. Chapter 10 opens, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem and Ham, and Shem, Ham and Japheth." The sixth verse talks of the sons of Ham. Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan. I'd hate to be named Phut. Cush begat Nimrod, verse 8 says. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And we are on verses 10 and 11, trying to sort out a difficulty. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calna in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher and built in Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. Not Calah, as I said earlier, but Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. I misspoke earlier when I said Calah is the great city. It's Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. Now, the difficulty is, if Nimrod was so great, ruling over a mighty kingdom, and as traditionally said, he drove Asher out of Shinar, who then built Nineveh and Rehoboth and Calah and Rezin was a great city, then Asher is pictured as being a ruler greater than Nimrod. And it's too hot now. Would Nimrod, therefore, the question is being asked by Alexander Hislop, as I read from the two Babylons, Asher is pictured as greater than Nimrod, and the question is asked, would Nimrod, of great as he was, put up with a competitor of that strength on his north flank? To obviate such difficulties, it has been proposed to render the words, out of that land he, Nimrod, went forth into Asher or Assyria. But to accomplish that, according to the ordinary use of grammar, the word in the original would have had to have been changed by copyists and should have been Ashura with the sign of motion to a place affixed to it in the original. And that isn't what it reads. It's Asher, not Ashura. Without any such sign of motion affixed. Hislop's right. He said, you don't have to change the word and presuppose a copy error from Asher to Ashura with a sign of motion attached. I am persuaded, Hislop says, that the whole perplexity that commentators have hitherto felt in considering this passage has arisen from supposing that there is a proper name in the passage. The original was all capital letters. We capitalize proper names. But that's a choice of the translators. Hyslop is right. He says the whole perplexity has risen from supposing that there's a proper name in the passage, where in reality no proper name exists or was intended. Asher, and as you know, these Old Testament languages are very limited in vocabulary. The context determines the meaning of many words. You can use the same word. It also is a passive participle of a verb, which in its Chaldee sense signifies to make strong, and consequently signifies being strengthened or made strong. That means the passage can be translated with no change in the words, just as accurately, to read as follows. And the beginning of his, Nimrod's, kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad or Akkad and Calneh. Out of that land, verse 11, he went forth being made strong, or when he had been made strong, and built a Nineveh, etc. That way, Asher is used with its alternative meaning, which is a participle of a verb, the passive form, and you have Nineveh as the builder of both 10 and 11. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. Out of that land, when he had been made strong, he went forth and built Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah and Rezin. You got it? So he was the builder not only of Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Having been made strong by establishing his kingdom there, he also went and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin. Thus, the Bible will exactly correspond with the ancient history of Justin. Justin's history reads, Ninus, or Ninus, strengthened the greatness of his acquired dominion by continued possession. Having subdued, therefore, his neighbors, when by an accession of forces, being still further strengthened, he went forth against other tribes, and every new victory paved the way for another, he subdued all the peoples of the east. Thus, then, Nimrod, or Ninus, was the builder of Nineveh, and the origin of the name of that city as the habitation of Ninus is accounted for, and light is thereby at the same time cast on the fact that the name of the chief part of the ruins of Nineveh to this day is Nimrud, spelled N-I-M-R-O-U-D. The importance of this is now we can gel the classical historians' accounts of the work of Ninus with the biblical account, requires no changing of the text. Just take the translator's use of the word as a proper name out and use it as a verb, which is its alternate. Nimrod, having been strengthened, went and expanded north, building more cities, Rezin being the most important one. Now, assuming that Ninus is Nimrod, the way in which that assumption explains what is otherwise inexplicable in the statements of ancient history greatly confirms the truth of that assumption itself. Ninus is said to have been the son of Belus or Bel. And Bel is said to have been the founder of Babylon. If Ninus was in reality the first king of Babylon, how could Belus, or Bel, his father, be said to be the founder of it? You want me to go on with that?
Yes, sir.
No, you don't?
Yes, sir.
Both might very well be, as will appear, if we consider who was Bel and what we can trace of his doings. If Ninus was Nimrod, who was the historical Bel? He must have been Cush. For the Bible in the 8th verse, Genesis 10, says, Cush begat Nimrod. And Cush is generally represented as having been a ringleader in the great apostasy. But again, Cush, as the son of Ham, for Hermes, or Mercury, you don't need to know this crap. Cush is the son of Ham, was Hermes or Mercury? For Hermes is just an Egyptian synonym for the son of Ham. You're not interested, it's too technical. The composition of Hermes is first from Her, which is in Chaldee synonymous with Ham, or Him, as we say, Khomeini, 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 K-H-E-M, Khum. It's a aspirate sound, Khum. Nobody can ever tell us for sure, and Khomeini ain't talking to anybody on the 6 o'clock news. Haven't you heard him variously referred to as Khomeini or Khomeini? Spelled K-H. Her in Chaldee is synonymous with Ham or Khem. K-H-E-M. The meaning of the name translates the burnt one. You know, there's some races have a head start in the tannin brigade. As the old joke goes, some were left in the oven longer than the others. The burnt one. Her, also like Ham, her in the, I don't think about women here, her in Chaldee, the word Chaldee word her for Hermes, also like Ham, signified the hot or burning one. This name formed a foundation for covertly identifying Ham with the sun and so deifying the great patriarch, after whose name the land of Egypt was called in connection with the sun. Khem, or Ham, in his own name was openly worshipped in later ages in the land of Ham. But this would have been too daring at first, because Noah was still around, and Shem and Japheth. By means of Her, the synonym, however, was paved for this. Her is the name of Horus, who is identified with the sun, which shows the real etymology of the name to be from the verb, which Hislipus just traced it from. Secondly, Mes, in the S, is from Emesha, or without the last radical, which is omissible. Mesh means to draw forth. In Egyptian, we have Miz, for the feminists, in the sense of to bring forth, which is evidently a different form of the same word. It's pretty technical. In the passive sense also, we find Ms., M-S, like the feminist. Ms. used in the same way. The radical mean of Mesha in Stockii lexicon is given in Latin, extraxit. And our English word extraction, as applied to birth or descent, shows that there's a connection between the generic meaning of this word and birth. This derivation will be found to explain the meaning of the names of the Egyptian kings, Rameses and Thothmes, the former evidently being the son of Ra, or the sun, for Ramesses is, in the Greek, Heliopais, the latter in like manner being the son of Thoth. For the very same reason, Hermes is the son of Her, or Ham, the burnt one, that is Cush. Got all that, didn't you? You did, didn't you? Smart bunch. Thus, Cush is the son of Ham, was Hermes, or Mercury. For Hermes is just an Egyptian synonym for the son of Ham. What I've been reading to you was a footnote. Now, Hermes was the great original prophet of idolatry, for he was recognized by the pagans as the author of their religious rites and the interpreter of the gods. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The distinguished Genesius identified him with the Babylonian Nebo as the prophetic god, and a statement of Hyginus shows that he was known as the grand agent in that movement which produced the division of tongues. Hyginus wrote, and these are his words, quote, "For many ages men lived under the government of Jove." Evidently not the Roman Jupiter, but the Jehovah of the Hebrews. "Without cities and without laws, and all speaking one language. But after that Mercury interpreted the speeches of men, whence an interpreter is called Hermeneutes," and they have classes in Bible school now, Hermeneutics, "the same individual distributed the nations. Then discord began." Here there is a manifest enigma. How could Mercury or Hermes have any need to interpret the speeches of mankind when they all spake one language? To find out the meaning of this, we must go to the language of the mysteries. Peresh in Chaldee signifies to interpret. That's P-E-R-E-S-H. Signifies to interpret. But was pronounced by old Egyptians and by Greeks, and often by the Chaldees themselves, in the same way as Peres, to divide. Mercury then, or Hermes, or Cush, the son of Ham, was the divider of the speeches of men. He, it would seem, had been the ringleader in the scheme for building the great city and Tower of Babel, and as the well-known title of Hermes, the interpreter of the gods, would indicate, had encouraged them in the name of God to proceed in their presumptuous enterprise, and so it caused the language of men to be divided and themselves to be scattered abroad on the face of the earth. Follow that? Now look at the name of Belus or Bel, given to the father of Ninus or Nimrod in connection with this. While the Greek name Belus represents both the Baal and Bel of the Chaldees, they were nevertheless two entirely distinct titles. These titles were both alike, often given to the same god, but they had totally different meanings. Baal, as we have already seen, signified the Lord, but Bel signified the confounder. When then we read that Belus, the father of Ninus, was he that built or founded Babylon, can there be a doubt in what sense it was that the title of Belus was given to him? It must have been in the sense of Bel the confounder. And to this meaning of the name of the Babylonian Bel, there's a distinct allusion in Jeremiah 1:2, where it is said, "Bel is confounded," that is, the confounder is brought to confusion. That Cush was known to pagan antiquity under the very character of Bel the confounder, a statement of Ovid very clearly proves. The statement to which I refer is that in which Janus, the god of gods, from whom all other gods had their origin, is made to say of himself, "The ancients called me Chaos." Now, first, this decisively shows that Chaos was known not merely as a state of confusion, but is the god of confusion. But secondly, who that is at all acquainted with the laws of Chaldaic pronunciation does not know that chaos is just one of the established forms of the name of Chus or Cush? Then look at the symbol of Janus. Come over here, please. Look at the symbol of Janus, whom the ancients called Chaos. And it will be seen how exactly it tallies with the doings of Cush when he's identified with Bel, the confounder. That symbol is a club. And the name of a club in Chaldee comes from the very word which signifies to break in pieces or scatter abroad. He who caused the confusion of tongues was he who broke the previously united earth in pieces and scattered the fragments abroad. How significant, then, as a symbol is the club as commemorating the work of Cush as Bel the confounder. And that significance will be all the more apparent when the reader turns to the Hebrew of Genesis 11:9 and finds that the very word from which a club derives its name is that which is employed when it is said that in consequence of the confusion of tongues, the children of men were scattered abroad on the face of the earth. The word there used for scattering abroad is hephates, which in the Greek form becomes hephais, and hence the origin of the well-known but little understood name of Hephaistos as applied to Vulcan, the father of the gods. Hephaistos is the name of the ringleader in the first rebellion as the scatterer abroad, as Bel is the name of the same individual and the confounder of tongues. Here, then, the reader may see the real origin of Vulcan's hammer, which is just another name for the club of Janus or Chaos, the god of confusion, and to this is breaking the earth in pieces. There is a covert allusion in Jeremiah 50:23, where Babylon, as identified with its primeval god, is thus apostrophized, "How is the hammer of the whole earth cut asunder and broken?" Babylon thus being referred to as the hammer of the whole earth. Now, as the tower building was the first act of open rebellion after the flood, and Cush as Bel was the ringleader in it, he was, of course, the first to whom the name Merodach, the great rebel, must have been given. And therefore, according to the usual parallelism of the prophetic language, we find both names of the Babylonian god referred to together when the judgment on Babylon is predicted. Bel is confounded, Merodach is broken in pieces, Jeremiah 52. The judgment comes upon the Babylonian god according to what he had done. As Bel, he had confounded the whole earth, therefore he is confounded. As Merodach, by the rebellion he had stirred up, he had broken the united world in pieces, therefore he himself is broken in pieces. So much for the historical character of Bel as identified with Janus or Chaos, the god of confusion, with his symbolic club. Proceeding then on... You follow that? Proceeding then on these deductions... I'm sure glad I don't have Jimmy Swaggart's congregation. So much for the historical character of Bel as identified with Janus or Chaos, the god of confusion, with his symbolical club. Proceeding then on these... Yeah, clubs. I'm not going to touch that. Clubs cause confusion, be they PTL or 700. I said I wouldn't touch it, but I did. Proceeding then on these deductions, it's not difficult to see how it might be said that Bel or Belus, the father of Ninus, founded Babylon, while nevertheless Ninus or Nimrod was properly the builder of it. Got that? Now, though Bel or Cush is being specially concerned in laying the first foundation of Babylon, might be looked upon as the first king, as in some copies of Eusebius' Chronicle he is so represented, yet it is evident from both sacred history and profane that he could never have reigned as king of the Babylonian monarchy, properly so called, and accordingly in the Arminian version of the Chronicle of Eusebius, or Eusebius, which bears the undisputed palm for correctness and authority, his name is entirely omitted in the list of Assyrian kings, that is, Bel or Cush, and that of Ninus stands first in such terms as exactly correspond with the scriptural account of Nimrod. Thus, then, looking at the fact that Ninus is currently made by antiquity the son of Belus, or Bel, when we have seen that the historical Bel is Cush, the identity of Ninus and Nimrod is still further confirmed. But when we look at what is said of Semiramis, the wife of Ninus, the evidence receives an additional development. That evidence goes conclusively to show that the wife of Ninus could be none other than the wife of Nimrod, and further to bring out one of the grand characters in which Nimrod was deified, when deified, was adored. In Daniel 11:38, I haven't gotten to that yet, we read of a god called Allah Mahozineh, that is, the god of fortifications. Who this god of fortifications could be, commentators have found themselves at a loss to determine. Who is it? This is too heavy, isn't it, for Monday night? Am I boring you? This might get ahead of my revelation preaching. I think we better pause a while, see if... Maybe you're just a select bunch in here, and they've already left us out there and are trying to find something simple. Just keep the gospel simple. Thou shalt not do anything. I think we better pause a while, and you better get on a telephone and let me know if you want me to continue. I don't have to... You know, I could play a rerun for you and just read to these people. They're pretty sharp in here tonight. All right, I'm reading from Alexander Hislop, The Two Babylons, tonight. Moving up through ancient history to the worship of the mother and child, so prominently portrayed in the traditions at Christmas time. Kind of heavy stuff. We're taking a break while you check in as a class and let me know whether you're kilt or not. We're identifying Nimrod and Semiramis. We've traced ancient historians in rather heavy stuff, reading from The Two Babylons, to show that whereas some classic historians refer to Ninus as the founder of Nineveh, a proper interpretation of the 10th and 11th verses that sees Asher as a verb, being strengthened instead of a proper name, then Ninus, as Nimrod, first built cities in the plain of Shinar, then being strengthened, built Nineveh and other cities to the north, one of them being a great city, Rezin. We have then traced the names of Hermes, Egyptian gods, and Mercury, the Greek god, in a rather heavy tracing of their etymological roots, to the designation son of Ham, which Cush was. And we see Cush, according to Hislop, as the one who brought about the confounding of the earth, the multiplication of languages, with the name Baal, Lord, first, as his designation, and Bel, the confounder, after the happening. Now we're looking at Semiramis. And we've just come to the point where Hislop refers to Daniel 11:38, where Antichrist will worship the god of fortifications. Who this god of fortifications could be, Hislop says, commentators have found themselves at a loss to determine. In the records of antiquity, how's that for a quick review? In the records of antiquity, the existence of any god of fortifications has been commonly overlooked. And it must be confessed that no such god stands forth there with any prominence to the ordinary reader. But of the existence of a goddess of fortifications. Not God, but goddess. There's ample evidence. That goddess is Cybele, who is universally represented with a mural or turreted crown, or with a fortification on her head. Why was Rhea the mother of mysteries, another designation of Semiramis, or Cybele, just another name for her, thus represented? The classic writer Ovid asked the question and answered it himself. And the answer is this. The reason, he says, why the statue of Cybele wore a crown of towers was because she first erected them in cities. The first city in the world after the flood, from whence the commencement of the world itself was often dated, that had towers and encompassing walls, was Babylon. And Ovid himself tells us that it was Semiramis, the first queen of that city, who was believed to have surrounded Babylon with a wall of brick. Semiramis, then, the first deified queen of that city and tower, whose top was intended to reach to heaven, must have been the prototype of the goddess who first made towers in cities. When we look at the Ephesian Diana, we find evidence to the very same effect. Here's a picture of Diana of Ephesus. A picture that has probably been seen by many of you, reproduced in various books. They made many images to her. When Paul came to the town, he caused trouble. See the tower on her head? Come in as close as you can. Oh, mini-boob Diana with a tower on her head. What a bitch she was. When we look at the Ephesian Diana, we find evidence to the very same effect. Now, don't go checking your records. That's not one of the seven words. In general, Diana was depicted as a virgin. All that waste. In general, Diana was depicted as a virgin. I got to find a copy of that book, General. In general, Diana was depicted as a virgin and the patroness of virginity, but the Ephesian Diana was quite different. She was represented with all the attributes of the mother of the gods. And as the mother of the gods, she wore a turreted crown, such as no one can contemplate without being forcibly reminded of the Tower of Babel. And you saw that in the picture. Now, this tower-bearing Diana is by an ancient scholar expressly identified with Semiramis. A scholiast on the periegesis of Dionysus, or Dionysius, says Lyard in his Nineveh and its Remains, makes Semiramis the same as the goddess Artemis or Despoigne. Now, Artemis was Diana or Despoigne, and the title of Despoigne given to her, showing that it was in the character of the Ephesian Diana she was identified with Semiramis. For Despoigne is the Greek for Domina, the lady, the peculiar title of Rhea, or Sibyl, the tower-bearing goddess in ancient Rome. And you know where Domina, the lady, has come in medieval religion. That was a footnote back to the body of this text. When therefore we remember that Rhea, or Sibyl, the tower-bearing goddess, was in fact a Babylonian goddess, and that Semiramis, when deified, was worshipped under the name of Rhea, there will remain, I think, no doubt as to the personal identity of the goddess of fortifications. Now, there's no reason to believe that Semiramis alone, though some have represented the matter so, built the battlements of Babylon. We have the express testimony of the ancient historian Megasthenes, as preserved by Abidinus, that it was Belus who surrounded Babylon with a wall. As Bel the confounder, who began the city and tower of Babel, had to leave both unfinished, this could not refer to him. Bel didn't finish the job. It could only refer to his son Ninus, or Nimrod, who inherited his father's title and who was the first actual king of the Babylonian Empire, and thus Nimrod. The real reason that Semiramis, the wife of Ninus, or Nimrod, gained the glory of finishing the fortifications of Babylon was that she came in the esteem of the ancient idolaters to hold a preponderating position, and to have attributed to her all the different characters that belonged or were supposed to belong to her husband. Having ascertained then one of the characters in which the deified wife was worshipped, we may from that conclude what was the corresponding character of the deified husband. Lollard distinctly indicates his belief that Rhea, or Sibyl, the tower-crowned goddess, was just the female counterpart of the deity presiding over bulwarks or fortresses, and that this deity was Ninus, Ninus, or Nimrod. We have still further evidence from what the scattered notices of antiquity say of the first deified king of Babylon under a name that identifies him as the husband of Rhea, the tower-bearing goddess. That other name for Ninus or Nimrod is Cronus or Saturn. Now let me read the footnote. In the Greek mythology, Cronus and Rhea are commonly brother and sister. Ninus and Semiramis, according to history, are not represented as standing in any such relationship to one another. But this is no objection to the real identity of Ninus and Cronus. For first, the relationship of the divinities in most countries are peculiarly conflicting. Osiris in Egypt is represented at different times not only as the son and husband of Isis, but also as her father and brother. Then, and Osiris is none other than Tammuz, son of Nimrod, Nimrod reborn again, and Isis is none other than Semiramis, or Diana, depending upon the culture and the name that she took in that culture. Secondly, whatever the deified mortals might be before deification, on being deified by successive people, they came into new relationships. On the apotheosis of husband and wife, it was necessary for the dignity of both that both alike should be represented as of the same celestial origin, as both supernaturally the children of God. Before the flood, the great sin that brought ruin on the human race was that the sons of God married others than the daughters of gods. In other words, those who were not spiritually their sisters. Well, he's on another subject there. I'll leave alone for the moment. In essence, they're both son and daughter. Do not go through the rest of this explanation of the footnote. As both being deified, they were the son and daughter of God, so they were brother and sister, husband and father and son. Got that? The name of Ninus or Nimrod. In another culture is Cronus or Saturn. It is well known that Cronus or Saturn was Rhea's husband. It is not so well known, though I've just said it, who was Cronus himself. Trace back to his original, that divinity, Cronus or Saturn, is proved to have been the first king of Babylon. Theophilus of Antioch shows that Cronus in the east was worshipped under the names of Bel or Baal. And from Eusebius we learn that the first of the Assyrian kings, whose name was Belus, was also by the Assyrians called Cronus. As the genuine copies of Eusebius do not admit of any Belus as an actual king of Assyria prior to Ninus, king of the Babylonians, and distinct from him, that shows that Ninus, the first king of Babylon, was Cronus. But further we find that Cronus was king of the Cyclopes, who were his brethren, who derived that name from him, and that the Cyclopes were known as the inventors of tower building. The king of the Cyclopes, the inventors of tower building, occupied a position exactly correspondent to that of Rhea, who first erected towers and cities. If therefore Rhea, the wife of Cronus, was the goddess of fortifications, Cronus or Saturn, the husband of Rhea, that is, Ninus or Nimrod, the first king of Babylon, must have been Allamahozen, the god of fortifications. And when Antichrist comes on the scene, the deduction of this logic is a return to Satan's counterfeit will be exalted by this Antichrist. Not satisfied to just engraft the mysteries of Babylon onto the church, the false church or the harlot woman in the last days will cause all to bow down and take the mark, which is the designation of possession and lordship over, of this one who worships again, Nimrod, or what he stood for. Interesting, isn't it? Well, keep it simple. Just don't do anything. The name Cronus itself goes not a little to confirm the argument. Cronus signifies the horned one, as a horn is a well-known oriental emblem for power or might. Cronus, the horned one, was, according to the mystic system, just a synonym for the scriptural epithet applied to Nimrod, namely, Gibber, the Mighty One. That's the way it's translated in Genesis 10:8. He began to be mighty on the earth. The name Cronus, as the classical reader becomes aware, is applied to Saturn as the father of the gods. Well, we already have had another father of the gods brought under our notice, even Cush in his character of Bel the Confounder, or Hephaistos, the scatterer abroad. And it's easy to understand how, when the deification of mortals began, and the mighty son of Cush was deified, the father, especially considering the part which he seems to have had in concocting the whole idolatrous system, would have to be deified too. That's normal. It's like, you know, after the virgin birth of Christ, they don't have to worry about the Father, but the church having the doctrine of original sin passed on through birth, since the belief in the virgin birth removed the Father contribution in an earthly sense, they had to deal with what about original sin passing through the mother. So then they propounded the theory of immaculate conception, that she was conceived immaculate, thus not bearing the stain of original sin, thus she couldn't pass it on to her son. Now, isn't it interesting? They were unwilling to have Jesus immaculately conceived. I mean, you know, if there's immaculate conception, It would be more logical to think the one that was born of the Spirit, of a virgin, might have a better chance being immaculately conceived than the mother. Yeah. I never heard of condoms for sin, but Mary's mother and dad had something working for them. Now, if the church could market those condoms, they wouldn't have to sell indulgences. This is getting heavy. As I was saying, if the Son is deified, you got to do something about the Father, like the Catholic Church had to do something about the Mother of Jesus. Son of Cush was deified. The Father, especially considering the part which he seems to have had in concocting the whole idolatrous system, would have to be deified too. And of course, in his character as the Father of the Mighty One and of all the immortals that succeeded him, he had to be deified. But in point of fact, we shall find in the course of our inquiry that Nimrod was the actual father of the gods, as being the first of deified mortals. False gods, that is. And that therefore it is in exact accordance with historical fact that Cronus, the horned, or Mighty One, is in the classic pantheon known by that title. The meaning of this name Cronus, the Horned One, as applied to Nimrod, fully explains the origin of the remarkable symbol, over here again, so frequently occurring among the Nineveh sculptures. The gigantic horned man-bull is representing the great divinities of Assyria. Here we go. Down here also. Thereby pointing back to the first of those mighty ones, who under the name of Gabri, occupied so prominent a place in the ancient world, and to whom the deified Assyrian monarchs covertly traced back the origin of their greatness and might. This explains the reason why Bacchus of the Greeks was represented as wearing horns, and why he was frequently addressed by the epithet bull-horned as one of the high titles of his dignity. Interesting footnote. You want it? The name for bull or ruler is in Hebrew, without points, sure, which in Chaldee becomes tur. Just join Texas. They don't know what in the hell we're talking about. I mean, bulls got their attention, you know. From tur, in the sense of a bull, comes the Latin taurus. And from the same word in the sense of a ruler, tyrannus, which originally had no evil meaning. Thus, in these well-known classical words, we have evidence of the operation of the very principle which caused the deified Assyrian kings to be represented under the form of the man-bull. Even in comparatively recent times, Toghrul Beg, the leader of the Seljukian Turks who came from the neighborhood of the Euphrates, was in a similar manner represented with three horns growing out of his head as the emblem of his sovereignty. This also in a remarkable way accounts for the origin of one of the divinities worshipped by our pagan Anglo-Saxon ancestors under the name Zernibogus. This Zernibogus was the black, evil, ill-omened divinity. In other words, the exact counterpart of the popular idea of a devil is supposed to be equipped with horns and hoofs. Are you following all this?
Yes, sir.
This name, analyzed and compared with the accompanying woodcut from Lollard, casts a very singular light on the source from whence has come the popular superstition in regard to the grand adversary, the devil. And this is the same picture again. The woodcut by Lollard, the great archaeologist who uncovered the ruins and remains of Nineveh. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Now, we just joined Texas and Kansas and Rochester and a lot of people. I'm reading from The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. We're moving along, identifying from archaeology and history and etymology the different names that Nimrod and Semiramis, who set up the first evil kingdom in opposition to God, the son of Cush, descendant of Ham, were identifying through archaeology, mythology, etymology, and other sources, done so well by Hislop, the biblical characters Nimrod and his wife Semiramis, who in the deification by their successors raised Semiramis to prominence, Nimrod reborn as Tammuz, as the mother and child symbol that grafted onto the medieval church and has become more important as the symbol of Christmas than any other single symbol. And Christmas is nothing other than that Babylonian commemoration of the birth of Tammuz. Nimrod reborn, heathen, evil, rebel against God, god of fortresses or fortifications, goddess of fortifications, that was set up as an anti-substitute system by Satan to somehow deflect mankind from receiving the truth of God in Christ. And Christmas is part of its tradition. That's why I say don't try to put Christ back into Christmas. He never was. He was born in September. It's a heathen festival. That doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy it. I think the non-Christians who don't know a thing about Christ or heathenism, they'd keep Christmas because of the turkey and the ham, and I'm dreaming of a white Christmas and red-nosed rainbow deer. Yeah, there are a lot of more modern cultural attachments, family centrifugal forces that bring us together that are a lot more important. Centrifugal or centripetal? Yeah, centripetal. Centrifugal spins out, right? Centripetal brings in. Centripetal forces. I like Christmas. I like Christmas because it produces a lot of sales right after. I like to outwit the people that exploit it. You should always give notes to people for Christmas saying, I'm going to buy you something costing this much, or don't put the price if you don't want it. I'm going to buy you what I plan to buy you right after Christmas, because I'm smart and I know you will appreciate me being smart. Or be even better yet is figure out what you're going to buy them and go price it, and then take half the money and put it in the present. Say, I'm giving you this cash, which is what I'm going to save for buying you what I was going to buy you right after Christmas. There are lots of things about Christmas I love. The day off's another thing I like. And all of the warm family things, the gathering around the tree, the burn of the candles, the drinking of the eggnog.
Yeah.
That's all right. What I'm quarreling against is this stupid attempt by the church to Christianize it, to perpetuate fables that will result in the loss of faith when people get smart enough to learn the truth about it. There's nothing wrong at all with the warmth of Christmas. I think it's fun to trace these facts, to be aware of the evil intent of the substitute, and to be aware of the power that Satan has had to overpower the simple truth of the gospel with these add-ons of the mystery religions, and to be aware of how foolish the church has been and what it's given up by trying to be all things to all men. Be intelligent about it, but then have fun. I'm going to put a Christmas tree up. I ain't got any. That phallic symbols don't bother me. Don't bother me at all. Don't sit under the Christmas tree with anybody else but me. Anybody else but me. Go ahead and sing that to your wife. It's all right. Or your husband. I just don't like Christianity made stupid. Too many people have lost their faith because of Christian stupidity. Facts are facts. The virgin birth is not necessary at all to my faith. If it were not for something else theological that I know that makes the virgin birth a necessary proof of God's faithfulness. Once God said and laid the law down that only a kinsman redeemer could redeem one who had lost his inheritance, then forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. God was bound by that word. He therefore had to save us through a kinsman. He thus had to kin the spirit nature of the Son Eternal, the eternal Word of God, with flesh. Now, he could have done it when the dove landed on his head. Once you accept the miracle-working power of God, he could have put his nature through Jesus of Nazareth from the feet of a dove. For all we know, the dove came down, hair stood on end, he shook, water boiled, and suddenly there's another nature put in him. God puts his nature in us without any reactions. The promise of God is that God's Spirit will be placed in us. Molecular displacement's nothing to him. He doesn't get the explosion we get. All things consist in him. Once the miracle-working power of God is accepted, he can place his nature in someone any way he wants to go about it. But then, God was only kinned and knows us and underwent what we go through and tempted as we've been tempted, not in all parts, but only as adults. It just makes more sense to me that the biblical record is the sensible way to do it. Instead of putting his nature in Jesus of Nazareth, produced by a union of Joseph and Mary, by using the feet of a dove, he chose do it in the womb of a woman. Work the miracle implant of his spirit, united with the egg in the womb of a woman, to kin the spirit nature of God with the fleshly nature that would come forth from her womb. And the virgin birth is simply one and probably the best way to obtain or achieve what his word demanded, that the one who redeemed us be kin to us. And that's why the Hebrews letter says, we don't have any choice. We're all flesh and blood. He chose to become partaker of flesh and blood, that in so doing he might be kin with us. Unless he were kin with us, his redeeming work would not meet the requirement that God's law laid down. There are other requirements. He had to have the means of redemption. That was perfection. Well, he had a problem if he kinned with us in a grown man through the feet of a dove. 30 years of shortfalling. That divine nature had to be there all along for the means of redemption to be obtained, namely perfection. So the logic of the virgin birth is a prerequisite that fulfills what God has said the Redeemer must have. And if God be God, who could speak and whole worlds be created by his word, no problem of his nature joining to the egg in a woman, and that dual nature coming forth and living throughout his lifetime, and though taking upon himself the likeness of sinning flesh, the power of the Spirit that was kinned with flesh in him overcame the flesh and obtained for him. He became perfect or complete through the suffering of his life and gave to him the means of redemption. He had to willingly do it and actually do it, and each of those were the four criteria of the kinsman redeemer. God, having laid that down as the criteria, was bound to do it that way. I don't have any trouble with the virgin birth. I can believe God created the heavens and the earth. I can believe that. More important is the logic of it. Now, those who don't want to believe in miracles say he became the Christ in this miraculous baptism or some other point along in his ministry. Doesn't make sense, because that robs him of the capacity of the perfection, because of the imperfection in the years prior to that ordination by God, when he would be sanctified or set apart and have implanted or placed in and through him the divine nature. He had it from the beginning. I born you?
No, sir.
Well, let's see. I want to pause on that bit of philosophizing for a moment. Are you the only ones interested, or you think they're interested? What's your opinion? Well, if they don't call, you pull a phone out by the roots and throw it at them. Now, I have to distinguish what I'm going to read from any hypersensitive person drawing some deduction or connection to racism. You will remember that, contrary to what a lot of people think, I taught you that it is more probable that the mark of Cain was that he was made white rather than black, that the rest of people were black and he was white. From the Celtic cauldron, it can be deduced that Noah was Mongolian, and the fact that Ham is looked at as the progenitor of the black races, and the names, as we traced them etymologically, the burnt one, ties into that, is a simple fact of biblical history and history in general. Even those who are not much on Christian or Hebrew or biblical theology trace the black races to Ham, particularly through Cush. Now, the fact that this Ham, through his descendants, was cursed has produced a fact of history of a burden of slavery on those people. My message is a message of the new race, where we all become one in Christ, born of the Spirit, citizens of heaven, joint heirs with Him, old things passed away, new creation in Christ Jesus. And it's ridiculous sometimes to get hung up on roots. That's the error of the people that have properly recognized who the lost tribes are. They want to go back and be like them. It'd be like a Christian discovering his grandmother was a, or his mother was a Jew and he was adopted. And as an orphan, finds his real mother was a Jew, so he goes to Israel and returns to Judaic practices, even though he's Christian. You don't go back, you go forward in the new beginnings to our inheritance in Christ, and old things are passed away, and the old man dies daily, and the new man's renewed, and newness of life is put in us, Christ's life. That makes us one in Him, kin together by His Spirit. So having said that, don't be sensitive, anybody, when I point out that the origin of one of the divinities worshipped by our pagan Anglo-Saxon ancestors under the name of Zernebogus was the black, malevolent, ill-omened divinity. It is not just a racist expression of white people that is so often pictured. The devil is black. In more modern pictures, they make him red. That ought to offend the Indians. It's because on earth, the substitute ruler, who was inspired by and created by Satan, was that descendant of the cursed one through Ham. The creation in Satan's master plan happened to be of that burnt one race. And when they were deified and the mortals were lifted up and made God through their own self-deification and by their followers later, then at times he was pictured as God, as we were talking last night, where Shem in conquering Ham was portrayed as the evil one in his attempt to restore the faith to Egypt because idolatry was widespread. In places where a faith against that idolatry is in the ascendancy, then the evil one is seen as black. Now, we're just joining some new people. I'm reading from the two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. Tracing through etymology, mythology, history, and various records, the identities and names of Nimrod, the first evil rebel against God, descendant of Ham, through Cush, who built Babylon and Nineveh, whose wife was Semiramis. We're linking it now in this book to the pagan Anglo ancestors who worshipped a divinity under the name of Zernebogus. Thus, Zernebogus was the black, malevolent, ill-omened divinity. In other words, the exact counterpart of the popular idea of the devil, supposed to be black, equipped with horns and hoops. This name analyzed and compared with the accompanying woodcut that we looked at in the earlier half hour from Lollard, the great archaeologist who dug up Nineveh's remains, casts a very singular light on the source from whence has come the popular superstition in regard to the devil. Let's look at the name Zernebogus. It breaks down in almost pure Chaldee, denoting the seed of the prophet Cush. We have seen reason already to conclude that under the name Bel, as distinguished from Baal, Cush was the great soothsayer and false prophet worshipped at Babylon. But independent inquirers have been led to the conclusion that Bel and Nebo were just two different titles for the same God, and that a prophetic God. Thus does Kiddo comment on the words of Isaiah 46:1, quote, Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. A common practice in the Old Testament to refer to the same person with two of his names. With reference to the latter name, the word seems to come from Nibba, or Neba, to deliver an oracle, or to prophesy. Hence would mean an oracle, and may thus, as Calmet suggests, be no more than another name for Bel himself or a characterizing epithet applied to him. Zernebagus, the great seed of the prophet Cush, was thus Nimrod, for Cush was Nimrod's father. Lawyard points out how this land of ours, England, he's writing from England, and Assyria are thus brought into intimate connection. In the woodcut referred to, first we find the Assyrian Hercules, that is Nimrod the giant, as he is called in the Septuagint version of Genesis, without club, spear, or weapons of any kind, attacking a bull. Having overcome it, he sets the bull's horns on his head as a trophy of victory and a symbol of power. And thenceforth the hero is represented not only with the horns and hoofs above, but from the middle downward with the legs and cloven feet of the bull. Thus equipped, he is represented as turning next to encounter a lion. Come to the woodcut again. Here is Hercules in the Assyrian woodcut version, conquering the bull, putting the bull's horns on his head, taking on the bull shape, and now taking on a lion. Follow it? Don't get too close. He didn't have any clothes on here. No big deal. Thus equipped, he is represented as turning next to encounter a lion. This, in all likelihood, is intended to commemorate some event in the life of him who first began to be mighty in the chase and in war, and who, according to all ancient traditions, was remarkable also for bodily power as being the leader of the giants that rebelled against heaven. And we'll find from the apocryphal books of the Old Testament, he had the power to overcome the animals that were bringing fear on mankind. Now Nimrod, as the son of Cush, was black. Can the Ethiopian change his skin? The King James reads. In the original it is, can the Cushite change his skin? Keeping this then in mind, it'll be seen that in the figure disentombed from Nineveh, this is just a reproduction of the woodcut that Lawyer dug up at Nineveh. In that figure, disentombed from Nineveh, we have both the prototype of the Anglo-Saxon Zernebagus, the seed of the prophet Cush, and the real original of the black adversary of mankind with horns and hoofs. It was in a different character from that of the adversary that Nimrod was originally worshipped. But among the Anglo-Saxons, it was inevitable that if worshipped at all, it must generally be simply an object of fear. And so Cronus, the Horned One, who wore the horns as the emblem both of his physical might and sovereign power, has come to be, in popular superstition, the recognized representative of the devil. In many and four severed countries, horns became the symbols of sovereign power. The corona or crown that still encircles the brows of European monarchs seems remotely to be derived from the emblem of might adopted by Cronus or Saturn, who, according to Pherecydes, was the first before all others that ever wore a crown. The first regal crown appears to have been only a band in which the horns were set. From the idea of power contained in the horn, even subordinate rulers seem to have worn a circlet adorned with a single horn in token of their derived authority. Bruce, the Abyssinian traveler, gives examples of Abyssinian chiefs thus decorated. Now, here's a picture of them. In regard to these chiefs, he states that the horn attracted his particular attention when he perceived that the governors of provinces were distinguished by this headdress. In the case of sovereign powers, the royal headband was adorned sometimes with a double, sometimes with a triple horn. The double horn had evidently been the original symbol of power or might on the part of sovereigns, for on the Egyptian monuments, the heads of the deified royal personages have generally no more than the two horns to shadow forth their power. As sovereignty in Nimrod's case was founded on physical force, so the two horns of the bull were the symbols of that physical force. And in accordance with this, we read in Sanchoniathon that Astarte put on her own head a bull's head as the ensign of royalty. By and by, however, another and a higher idea came in, and the expression of that idea was seen in the symbol of the three horns. The cap seems, in course of time, to have come to be associated with the regal horns. In Assyria, the three-horned cap was one of the sacred emblems, in token that the power connected with it was of celestial origin, the three horns evidently pointing at the power of the Trinity. Still, we have indications that the horn band without any cap was anciently the corona or royal crown. The crown borne by the Hindu god Vishnu in his avatar of the fish is just an open circle or band with three horns standing erect from it with a knob on the top of each horn. Here's a picture of it. All the avatars are represented as crowned with a crown that seems to have been modeled from this, consisting of a coronet with three points standing erect from it, in which Sir William Jones recognizes the Ethiopian or Parthian coronet, the open tiara of Agni, the Hindu god of fire, shows in its lower round the double horn, made in the very same way as in Assyria, proving at once the ancient custom and whence that custom had come. Instead of the three horns, three horn-shaped leaves came to be substituted. Here's a picture. Yeah, I'm going close on this one. And thus the horned band gradually passed into the modern coronet or crown with the three leaves of the fleur-de-lis or other familiar three-leaved adornings. Among the Red Indians of America, there had evidently been something entirely analogous to the Babylonian custom of wearing the horns. For in the buffalo dance, there each of the dancers had his head arrayed with buffalo horns. And it is worthy of a special remark that the satyric dance, or dance of the satyrs in Greece, seems to have been the counterpart of this Red Indian solemnity. For the satyrs were horned divinities, and consequently those who imitated their dance must have had their heads set off in imitation of theirs. When thus we find a custom that is clearly founded on a form of speech that characteristically distinguished the region where Nimrod's power was wielded, used in so many different countries far removed from one another, where no such form of speech was used in ordinary life, we may be sure that such a custom was not the result of mere accident, but that it indicates the widespread diffusion of an influence that went forth in all directions from Babylon from the time that Nimrod first began to be mighty on the earth. There was another way in which Nimrod's power was symbolized besides the horn. A synonym for Geber, the mighty one, was Abir, while Aber also signified a wing. Nimrod is the head and captain of those men of war by whom he surrounded himself and who were the instruments of establishing his power, was Baal-Abirin, Lord of the Mighty Ones. But Baal-Abirin, pronounced nearly the same way, Baal-Abirin, A-B-E-R-I-N, and Baal-Abirin, A-B-I-R-I-N, pronounced essentially the same way, signified the winged one, and therefore in symbol he was represented not only as a horned bull, but as at once a horned and winged bull, as showing not merely that he was mighty himself, but that he had mighty ones under his command who were ever ready to carry his will into effect and to put down all opposition to his power, and to shadow forth the vast extent of his might. He was represented with great and wide expanding wings. To this mode of representing the mighty kings of Babylon and Assyria who imitated Nimrod and his successors, there's a manifest allusion in Isaiah 8, 6-8. Quote, "For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Ramaliah's son, now therefore behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river strong and mighty, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go out, he shall reach even unto the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of the land, O Emmanuel." When we look at such figures as those which are here presented, and one of the most amazing stories of archaeology is while you're digging these winged bulls up, giant-sized, from Nineveh first, and shipping them down the river. One of the rafts capsized and they lost them. Others made it to the British Museum and can be seen there today. This is the winged bull from Nimrod, Nimrod, the one above. With their great extent of expanded wings as symbolizing an Assyrian king at Nineveh, what a vividness and force does it give to the language of the prophet? The knowledge of the way in which the Assyrian monarchs were represented and of the meaning of that representation gives additional force to the story of the dream of Cyrus the Great as told by Herodotus, the Greek historian. Cyrus, says the historian, dreamt that he saw the son of one of his princes, who was at the time in a distant province with two wings, wings on his shoulders, the one of which overshadowed Asia and the other Europe, from which he immediately concluded that he was organizing rebellion against him. The symbols of the Babylonians, whose capital Cyrus had taken and to whose power he had succeeded, were entirely familiar to him, and if the wings were the symbols of sovereign power, and the possession of them implied lordship over the might or the armies of the empire, it's easy to see how very naturally any suspicion of disloyalty affected the individual in question might take shape in the manner related when he sees dreams of these wings rising up in Europe and Asia. Now, the understanding of this equivocal sense of Baal-Abirin can alone explain the remarkable statement of Aristophanes that at the beginning of the world, the birds were first created, and then after their creation came the race of the blessed immortal gods. This has been regarded as either an atheistical or nonsensical utterance on the part of the poet. But with the true key applied to the language, it is found to contain an important historical fact. Let it only be borne in mind that the birds, that is, the winged ones, symbolize the lords of the mighty ones, and then the meaning is clear, namely that men first begin to be mighty on the earth, and then that the lords or leaders of these mighty ones were deified. The knowledge of the mystic sense of this symbol accounts also for the origin of the story of Perseus, the son of Jupiter, miraculously born of Danae, who did such wondrous things and who passed from country to country on wings divinely bestowed on him. This equally casts light on the symbolic myths in regard to Bellerophon and the feats which he performed on his winged horses and their ultimate disastrous issue, how high he mounted in the air and how terrible was his fall, and of Icarus, the son of Daedalus, who flying on wax-cemented wings over the Icarian Sea, had his wings melted off through his too near approach to the sun, and so gave his name to the sea where he was supposed to have fallen. The fables all referred to those who trod, or were supposed to have trodden, in the steps of Nimrod, the first Lord of the Mighty Ones, and who in that character was symbolized as equipped with wings. Now, it is remarkable that in the passage of Aristophanes, already referred to, that speaks of the birds or the winged ones being produced before the gods, we are informed that he from whom both mighty ones and gods derive their origin was none other than the winged boy Cupid. Aristophanes says that Eros or Cupid produced the birds and gods by mingling all things. This evidently points to the meaning of the name Bel, which signifies at once the mingler and the confounder. This name properly belonged to the father of Nimrod, but as the son was represented as identified with the father, we have evidence that the name descended to the son and others by inheritance. Cupid, the son of Venus, occupied, as will afterwards be proved, in the mystic mythology the very same position as Nin or Ninus, the son, did to Rhea, the mother of the gods. As Nimrod was unquestionably the first of the mighty ones, after the flood, this statement of Aristophanes that the boy god Cupid, himself a winged one, produced all the birds or winged ones, while occupying the very position of Nin or Ninus the son, shows that in this respect also Ninus and Nimrod are identified. While this is the evident meaning of the poet, this also, in a strictly historical point of view, is the conclusion of the historian Apollodorus, for he states that Ninus is Nimrod. And then in conformity with this identity of Ninus and Nimrod, we find in one of the most celebrated sculptures of ancient Babylon, Ninus and his wife Semiramis represented as actively engaged in the pursuit of the chase, the quiver-bearing Semiramis being a fit companion for the mighty hunter before the Lord. Now let's turn to Egypt. You with me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, no, you know, you only have to remember one thing. Nimrod and Ninus are the same. And Cush was the old man. And Samiris the broad. And we're going to get to Christmas. I'm telling you, there's a lot more to it than straw and cows and manger. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Shall I go to Egypt?
Yes, sir.
We'll get to Rome. And when we get to Rome, we'll get to Christianity. When we get to Christianity, we'll get to Beverly Hills. And Los Angeles. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
It's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? Huh? Well, I've been getting you ready for 11 years. You know, some of you look kind of big-eyed and bug-eyed. We've been going at it for 2.5 hours, am I? I've only begun. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Well, when we turn to Egypt, we find remarkable evidence of the same thing there also. Justin, as we've already seen, says that Ninus, who now we know as Nimrod, subdued all nations as far as Libya. Consequently, all across North Africa, including Egypt. The statement of Diodorus Siculus is to the same effect, Egypt being one of the countries that, according to him, Ninus brought into subjection to himself. In exact accordance with these historical statements, we find that the name of the third person in the primeval triad of Egypt was Khons or Khons. Khons. But Khons or Khons or Khons in Egyptian comes from a word that signifies to chase. Therefore, the name of Khons, the son of Maut, the goddess mother, who was adorned in such a way as to identify her with Rhea, the great goddess mother of Chaldea, properly signifies the huntsman, or god of chase. As Khons stands in the same relationship to the Egyptian Maut that Ninus does to Rhea, how does this title of the huntsman identify the Egyptian god with Nimrod? Now, this very name, Khons, brought into contact with the Roman mythology, not only explains the meaning of a name in the pantheon there, that hitherto has stood greatly in need of explanation, but causes that name, when explained, to reflect light back again on the Egyptian divinity and to strengthen the conclusion already arrived at. The name to which I refer is the name of the Latin god Consus, who was in one aspect identified with Neptune, but who was also regarded as, quote, the god of hidden counsels or the concealer of secrets, who was looked up to as the patron of horsemanship and was said to have produced the horse. Who could be the god of hidden counsels or the concealer of secrets? Now we found who the goddess and god of fortifications is. Who is the god of hidden counsels or the concealer of secrets? You look too sleepy to me. Get on the telephone again. Beg me a little. I'm going to go home.